org. I'll be speaking today at Dolly's Bookstore on Main Street here in Park City at 1 p.m. It's a free event. Everyone's invited. You can visit our website for details. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Anna Ozbeck, and Sam Riddell. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Special thanks to John Hamilton, Dennis Moynihan, Elizabeth Press, Brenda Murad, Chuck Skurich, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, David Pruden, Sharina Nudura. Our director is Becca Staley. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. And special thanks to our team here at Park City Television, Stanton Jones, Kevin Rapp, Evan Heath, Aaron Springsteen, Craig Van Strelen, Corey Reno, Yorivia Barrios, and Randy Thieben. Again, our website, democracynow.org, will be in New York on Monday. If you can go to our website at Democracy Now!, you'll see transcripts, video, audio, podcasts, as well as columns and web exclusives. I'm Amy Goodman from Park City Television. Thanks so much for joining us.
We just got done listening to Democracy Now! Right here on KBOO, and that program was made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. The time is 5 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
Tune in to KBOO Friday, January 30th at 8 p.m. for a 13-hour celebration of Alan Lomax on his 100th birthday.
Get on board, little children, and ride with me. This is Alan Lomax, your ballad man, inviting you for a ride on the folk song train, the train that runs wherever the people sing, wherever the people make their music.
KBOO hosts and special guests will be playing excerpts from Alan Lomax's long life of field recording. We'll play radio shows, field recordings, interviews, and more. That's the Alan Lomax Centennial Celebration with 13 hours of special programming, Friday, January 30th at 8 p.m. to Saturday, the 31st at 9 a.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Wondering what to do for Valentine's Day? Sword fights, tap dancing, prizes, and a talent show are just a few of the exciting acts you'll see at this year's KBOO benefit, Contessa de la Luna's Valentine Spectacular. Don't miss this annual event that is sure to delight and amaze your eyes and ears. Let La Contessa entertain you Thursday, February 12, 2015, at the Clinton Street Theater. This is the perfect Valentine date night. Show starts at 7 p.m. That's Thursday, February 12, 7 p.m., Clinton Street Theater. Tickets available now. Go to kboo.fm/talent show.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, St. Louis, Missouri prepares to implement a civilian oversight committee to review police abuse following a meeting disrupted by police union leaders.
CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling faces 80 years in prison following his conviction on treason charges.
90 local employees of Safeway will lose their jobs as the company prepares to merge with Albertsons.
And good evening, everybody. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 30th, 2015. I'm Paul Rowland.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. In Ferguson, Missouri this week, a public hearing on civilian oversight of the police erupted in chaos when the head of the Police Officers Association challenged one of the committee members on how the meeting was being run. The White Police Association leader was wearing a wristband that said, "I am Darren Wilson." This is a reference to an officer who shot and killed 18-year-old Darren Wilson last August and was not charged with any crime. In the public meeting Wednesday, the officer pushed one woman down to the floor, and the audience in the crowd adhering for a room rose up to challenge his aggressive action. Here's a clip of the local news report.
In my function and disappointment.
And that went on for several minutes. Here is what witnesses are saying happened. A woman says she was getting up to leave when she says she was pushed aside by Jeff Rorta. That's the head of the Police Officers Association, as he was addressing the committee chair, Alderman Terry Kennedy.
Following the disruption, the hearing in St. Louis heard more impassioned pleas from community members for a new civilian oversight board that will have the power to challenge police officers who engage in abuses. As of today, the bill to create a civilian oversight board for St. Louis police appears headed for passing. A majority of the Board of Aldermen have already affixed their names as co-sponsors of the bill, which would create a 7-member civilian board to investigate police misconduct allegations. Mayor Francis Slay has even taken an unusual step of adding his name to the bill as a sign of support. The city's police officers union is opposed to the civilian oversight board. Jeff Rorta, the police union official who disrupted Wednesday's meeting, said on Thursday that St. Louis police officers will quit the department or do only the bare minimum on patrol if the city creates the kind of civilian oversight board that is currently being proposed.
A high school teacher and activist has filed a lawsuit against the city of Seattle after a police officer sprayed chemical irritant directly into his face as he left a peaceful rally on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Jesse Hagopian, who spoke at the event about how Black Lives Matter, was making arrangements by cell phone with his mother to attend his son's second birthday party when he passed a Seattle police officer screaming at passersby. A video of the incident shows the officer and some others standing at a police barricade. The officer is shown ordering a small, peaceful crowd, most of whom were walking past the police, to disperse. Hagopian said officers set up a barricade with their bicycles to prevent protesters from marching, and he said some participants walked through the line, but he did not. The video shows a peaceful march, and Hagopian enters the scene talking on his cell phone. Suddenly, the officer blasts pepper spray directly into the teacher's face. Hagopian and the woman next to him immediately ducked for cover, and the crowd scattered. Video of the incident was uploaded to YouTube on Wednesday, the same day Hagopian's attorney filed a lawsuit against the city. A spokesman for the police department said he had not seen the video and was unable to comment.
A local branch of the Daimler Chrysler Corporation has agreed to pay nearly $2.5 million to settle discrimination lawsuits brought by former employees. This is the largest civil rights settlement ever made against a company in the state of Oregon. The settlement ends 6 different lawsuits filed by former employees of the company's manufacturing plant on Swan Island. The agreement also settles a complaint brought by Oregon Labor Commissioner that claimed that employees at the company engaged in racial discrimination, the creation of a hostile work environment, and a failure to take appropriate corrective action. Minority employees working for Daimler Trucks have alleged being subjected to racial slurs, offensive graffiti, and physical threats. One employee described a coworker displaying a noose and threatening to drag the employee behind his car. Daimler Trucks North America is owned by a German-based Daimler AG and is the largest manufacturer of heavy-duty trucks in North America. Daimler employs approximately 2,000 people in its Portland plant. The company has agreed to take proactive measures to eliminate workplace discrimination and harassment, but has not admitted any liability in the settled cases.
Safeway Corporation has announced the layoffs of 91 workers in the Portland area, following a nearly $10 million merger with Albertsons. The Federal Trade Commission ordered the parent company of Albertsons, which carried out the merger with Safeway, to close 168 stores. The closures are a condition of the merger in order to prevent a monopoly. In addition to the 91 Safeway workers from the Clackamas regional office who will lose their jobs, 20 local Albertsons stores will be sold. The stores will be purchased by the Bellingham, Washington-based Hagen grocery chain. Among these stores are the Albertsons in Beaverton, Clackamas, Lake Oswego, Milwaukee, Sherwood, Tigard, and West Lynn. 3 years ago, Hagen changed ownership, and the new owners closed a third of the stores owned by the company. It's not yet known if a similar fate is in store for the 20 local Albertsons stores that will be bought by Hagen.
Get out your camping gear, folks. The city of Portland is temporarily suspending its ban on camping until Tuesday, February 3rd. As part of an attempt to count the number of homeless people in Portland, the city has asked police agencies to suspend their enforcement of no camping laws. Consequently, houseless people throughout the city can relax for a few days in the confidence that they will not be woken up and hassled while they rest. At the same time, the city's anti-camping law is under review in court. At a hearing on January 23rd, Multnomah County Circuit Judge Stephen Bouchong reviewed the legality of the city's ordinance. During the hearing, an attorney for Multnomah County said that the definition of campsite is overly broad and could include, for example, a family having a picnic in the park. The judge responded by asking whether the camping ban is applied uniformly or if houseless people are specifically profiled for enforcement. The selective enforcement of the anti-camping law could end up being its undoing if the judge rules that the statute is too broad. Judge Bouchong also happens to be the same judge who threw out Portland's sit-lie ordinance in 2009.
A University of Oregon economics professor has given back some 22,000 pages of documents that he had tried to release to the public. Bill Harbaugh had tried to leak the documents because he said the university was trying to hide information that should have been made public. He returned the documents when the university agreed to make most of the information in the documents available in public archives. At the same time, University of Oregon's interim president, Scott Coltrane, pledged to overhaul records procedures. The files, according to UO, had included confidential data on faculty, students, and administrators. That information will be removed before the documents are made public.
Challengers to a boycott of Israeli goods at the Olympia Food Co-op in Washington State continue to press their lawsuit, taking it all the way to the Washington State Supreme Court. A judge ruled last year in favor of the co-op, saying that they followed all of their own policies and were in their rights as a nonprofit business to boycott Israeli products. The boycott of Israeli products is a global movement aimed at pressuring Israel to end its discriminatory policies and laws against Palestinians and to stop the illegal occupation of Palestinian land. When the Olympia Food Co-op voted to join the global boycott, five members sued the co-op to get them to overturn the boycott. The anti-boycott members lost the lawsuit and also lost an appeal. A judge ordered them to pay the co-op back for the legal fees they incurred, but that payment has not yet been made since the plaintiffs have taken the case all the way to the state Supreme Court. KBOO's Joanne Peterson spoke with Maria LaHood, the staff attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights, about this case.
It sounds like this lawsuit has stretched to almost 4 years now. What specifically happened in the suit that made it go to Supreme Court?
Well, the plaintiffs are arguing that the anti-SLAPP statute was improperly applied and also that the anti-SLAPP statute's unconstitutional. There were a few cases before the Supreme Court this term, three, where the constitutionality of the anti-SLAPP statute was challenged. One of those cases, a decision just came out, and the Supreme Court actually found in that case that the statute wasn't properly applied, but it, you know, spoke somewhat favorably of the anti-SLAPP statute. So, you know, we have no idea, of course, what the court will do, but we're hoping that it will uphold the constitutionality of the anti-SLAPP statute and, in our case, find that it was properly applied.
And what types of things are the plaintiffs saying makes this an inappropriate use of an anti-SLAPP suit?
They claim that there was a boycott staff policy in the co-op, which permitted staff to pass a boycott by consensus. On this issue, the staff was not able to reach consensus and had brought it to the board. So plaintiffs claim, well, they didn't abide by the staff policy, but the staff policy didn't apply to the board. And also, the board was able to pass a boycott regardless staff policy. You know, even the plaintiffs concede that the board members could have changed the staff policy. You know, in that same vote, they could have said, well, we're changing the policy and we boycott Israeli goods. But they're claiming that because they didn't do that, they exceeded their authority. And also the policy required that the boycott be nationally recognized, which the lower court found that, in fact, it is, you know, the boycott against Israel is nationally as well as internationally recognized. They claim that it's not, or that the board didn't find that. You know, we, again, argue that the board has the authority to boycott Israeli goods under the bylaws without regard to what the staff policy says. But anyway, it is nationally recognized.
Do you think this case will set precedent for other states?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, the anti-SLAPP statutes around across other states are all somewhat different. You know, there are a couple that are very similar to Washington. Those have actually been upheld as constitutional. No statute in any state, no anti-SLAPP statute, has been struck down as unconstitutional.
Since the defendants haven't been reimbursed for legal fees and whatnot, how has this affected the co-op's ability to continue working?
I'm afraid that it, like other, you know, any SLAPP case, is probably somewhat chilling people. You know, litigation is horrible to go through. But the co-op itself is, as far as I know, doing extremely well. You know, I think its membership increased. It's doing fine. Unfortunately, I think, you know, the fact that people decided to sue when there were many opportunities before them to resolve this dispute otherwise. They not only could they have brought it to a membership vote, you know, there's a grievance procedure for disputes they could have used. They didn't do that. They could have done a petition to try to change the bylaws. They didn't do that. They didn't seek to resolve it in any way within the corporate structure or in any way that was amicable. They chose to litigate. That, unfortunately, I think has been very hard on people. And it's very stressful for people to be subject to litigation. One of our clients actually passed away in the 4 years. And, you know, the fact that case has actually outlived one of our clients is difficult. So it's unfortunate. And we're hoping that it will be over soon.
I've been speaking with Maria LaHood, who is a senior staff attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights. We've been discussing a lawsuit against Olympia Food Co-op board members for boycotting Israeli goods. For KBOO News, I'm Joanna Peterson.
A little bit of Talking Heads there for you. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for media analysis on Counterspin, featuring Mark Weisbrot speaking about the Greek elections. He asks if what the elite media really fear isn't that Syriza will fail, but that it might succeed. Also, we'll hear from Amanda Marcotte on how the new Congress threatens women's rights. This will be followed by KBOO's weekly feminist public affairs program, Bread and Roses, at 6. And at 7 is Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. On tonight's show, host Davey D speaks with legendary radio programmer and media justice advocate Bob Law about the state of black media. Tomorrow's weather is sunny again with a high of 56. On Sunday, a bit cooler with a high of 48 and a 70% chance of rain. Today in history, on January 30th, 1848, Mahatma Gandhi was assassinated by a Hindu extremist. Gandhi was known worldwide for his nonviolent freedom struggle against British colonial rule in India. The quote of the day is from Mahatma Gandhi, who said, "Happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony."
Earlier this week, CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling was convicted on 9 felony counts and may be sentenced to as many as 80 years in prison. Sterling allegedly released information relating to a CIA plot to provide Iran with inaccurate blueprints of the manufacture of nuclear weapons.
Earlier today, KABU reported that Sterling had been positively identified as the one who leaked information about the CIA plan to the New York Times. That is not correct, as the Times reporter in question, James Risen, has never identified Sterling as his source. Sterling did, however, report to the Senate Intelligence Committee that he thought the plan to send faulty nuclear blueprints to Iran could backfire. According to retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, the CIA plot, codenamed Operation Merlin, was part of the Bush administration's efforts to construct a rationale for an attack on Iran. McGovern spoke with Chris Andre on KABU's Air Cascadia about the conviction of Sterling.
The point that the defense attorneys made throughout the trial, that the CIA was attempting to use this trial to resuscitate their reputation, which is probably impossible to do anyway. But, of course, people were very familiar. Many people were very familiar with the role of the New York Times reporter James Risen in this, and Jeffrey Sterling sort of got overlooked in the lead up to this trial. Sterling allegedly leaked classified information to James Risen of the New York Times regarding a really insane plan by the CIA, which they were implementing, to provide Iran with nuclear weapons plans that had flaws in them that supposedly they wouldn't recognize. And the jury was deadlocked on several counts as they came back just 2 or 3 hours before they rendered their verdict. And they said they were deadlocked, and then they went back and suddenly came out with a unanimous verdict. Some of us tried to talk to jurors, but they sort of left in a group and would not talk to anyone. So they apparently, although this, I always call this an evidence-free case, there was circumstantial evidence, but nothing to link Risen having received an actual document or any information from Sterling. There was no evidence introduced that Sterling, you know, anybody saw him take out a document or that he transferred anything on his own computer. They found nothing of that sort when they searched his house. There was an interesting chronology, I will say, and the defense argued they've got a theory of the case but no evidence. We have a theory too, they said, which is that it was somebody perhaps from the Senate Intelligence Committee or someone else who was knowledgeable about the program. There were, even though this is supposedly a closely held program, there were 90 some people within the CIA, and then people on the Senate Intelligence Committee, then headed by Republican Pat Roberts of Kansas, and the FBI originally, and the FBI agent in charge, wrote a report back several years before they named Sterling as the prime suspect, saying Sterling probably was not the guilty party. It was probably somebody in the Senate committee. But then they were blocked from interviewing anybody who was active on the Senate committee. The chairman and the chief of staff there said, "No way, we're going to cooperate with you."
That was Ray McGovern speaking about the conviction of Jeffrey Sterling, the CIA whistleblower, this week. He faces up to 80 years in prison. After having promised to be the most transparent administration ever, the Obama administration has prosecuted more whistleblowers than all other previous administrations combined.
Monsanto's shareholders will gather for their annual meeting today. But this year, they're joined by a coalition of parents, doctors, and food safety advocates who say that Monsanto is making them sick. The coalition pinpoints the company's genetically modified crops and pesticides as the root of multiple human health issues, including cancer and possibly autism. The coalition plans to attend the shareholders' meeting, where they will present a proposal for increased corporate accountability. The group will also host a memorial to those who have been victims of Monsanto's products. This demonstration is only one in a series of worldwide protests against Monsanto, and the way the protesters claim the company undermines farm workers and contributes to environmental damage, monoculture, and increased use of herbicides.
A lawsuit challenging President Barack Obama's executive action on immigration is before a federal court in Brownsville, Texas. 25 states, including Texas, signed on to the case seeking an injunction to block expansion of the Deferred Action Program that would include an estimated 5 million undocumented immigrants. As part of the case, U.S. District Judge Andrew Hannon will weigh the merits of a common legal concept known as prosecutorial discretion. Anthony J. Rivera reports from Washington, D.C.
If a police officer has ever let you off with a warning, you've benefited from prosecutorial discretion. In many ways, the idea is simple. Police have limited resources. They can't put every reckless driver or graffiti artist in jail. There's also the exception to the rule. A cop who sees a homeless person sleeping on a hot city vent on a freezing night may let it slide due to that person's limited options for staying warm. Where it gets complicated is how that discretion is applied from person to person. As part of a legal challenge now before him, Judge Andrew Hannon of the Southern District of Texas must determine, among other things, if he thinks the president abused the use of prosecutorial discretion by expanding his deferred action program to include qualifying parents of U.S.-born children or of legal permanent residents. Many Republicans on Capitol Hill call this amnesty. Here's Melissa Crowe from the American Immigration Council.
I think one of the sticking points in this case is, or one of the points that Judge Hannon was most or seemed most concerned about was whether this is a program that requires adjudicators to exercise case-by-case discretion.
Crowe says her organization has seen applicants for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, denied prosecutorial discretion, even though they satisfied all of the thresholds to avoid deportation. Crowe says this element of immigration policy is at the heart of the issue.
The government said in the argument in Texas that they were going to focus more on that in the brief that will be filed at the end of this week. So we do hope to see that.
Congressional Republicans have been riled up about this issue since the president announced his executive action on immigration in November. Obama argues congressional inaction forced his hand. Democratic Congressman Luis Gutierrez of Illinois says immigration reform is something that even conservative members have been seeking clarity on for many years now. Gutierrez, a staunch supporter of comprehensive immigration reform, has continuously assailed opponents of the president's actions for what he calls hypocrisy.
So let's just put aside the fallacy that somehow this is disruptive to a system. It's almost as though you're coming here to tell us, oh, we were on the pinnacle of success, and had the president not acted, we'd all be convened here to do comprehensive immigration reform.
No matter what Judge Hannon rules, the immigration fight isn't expected to go away. In addition to the lawsuit underway in Brownsville, House Republican leaders are now in the process of crafting their own legal challenge to the president's executive action. For FSRN, I'm Anthony J. Rivera in Washington.
Mexican authorities have officially closed the investigation into the 43 students who went missing in Iguala in September. The case has become emblematic of Mexico's larger crisis of disappearances at the hands of state actors and of the sometimes unclear line between authorities and organized crime. Shannon Young with Free Speech Radio News has more on this story.
No podemos proporcionar un estimado de éxito.
In a lengthy press conference, Mexico's Attorney General Jesus Murillo Caram announced the end of the investigation into the fate of 43 students from the Ayotzinapa Teachers College, declaring that the Guerreros Unidos organized crime group killed them all.
23:20 horas.
The centerpiece of the press conference was a 26-minute long video reenactment of the events of September 26th and 27th, complete with computer animation, fragments of videotaped confessions, and crime scene images laid over a bed of looped guitar riffs. The official version of events rests largely on the statements of presumed members of the drug gang, who say they killed the students, burned their bodies and belongings at an area dump, and destroyed as much of the physical evidence as possible. The detainees say they gathered the charred remains of the students into plastic bags and threw them into a nearby river. Those remains were sent to a specialized forensics lab at the University of Innsbruck in Austria, which was able to positively identify only one student. Last week, the forensics experts said the rest of the remains were too damaged to yield conclusive results via mitochondrial DNA tests and are now conducting more sensitive sequencing tests. Attorney General Jesus Murillo Caram says the confessions coincide with evidence of a large fire in the dump, the presence of ammunition shell casings there, and a bag of charred bone fragments and ashes pulled from the San Juan River.
Sin lugar a dudas.
Without a doubt, the Normalista students were abducted, killed, incinerated, and thrown into the San Juan River, in that order. This is the historic truth behind the events.
Parents of the Ayotzinapa students aren't so sure.
Los acuerdos que signó Enrique Peña Nieto.
Parent and spokesperson Felipe de la Cruz said learning that officials closed the case through a press conference violated an agreement signed last year by the president that stipulated the parents would receive direct notice of any major developments on the case. He added the parents refused to accept a version of events based solely on detainee statements and insisted they want scientific proof. The parents are dubious about the detainee's version of events and the authenticity of other evidence cited by the attorney general. So are other independent investigators and forensics experts, including Jorge Antonio Montemayor, a scientist with the National University's Institute of Physics.
Demostramos que es absoluta y totalmente imposible que los hayan cremado en Cocula.
Montemayor testified last week at a congressional forum on disappearances that the heat needed for a fire to reduce bodies to ashes and destroy DNA requires a closed environment, like a crematorium, and he is sure it could not occur in an open-air dump.
A simple physics analysis that any one of my students could have done, any one of the chemical engineers, biologists, military engineers could have done, but didn't. The technicians I know who work under the Attorney General are not imbeciles. They're well trained. Why didn't they do these studies? Because they obey orders from above. They're scared. Of getting fired? No, they're scared of getting killed.
Montemayor added that he has received multiple threats since coming forward to counter the official explanation and called for international investigators less susceptible to threats against themselves and their families. The students' families also say that authorities locked in early on the detainee's story and have failed to investigate another working theory about the disappearances that involves soldiers at Iguala's military base. So far, the only authorities charged in the case are police from Iguala and Cocula, as well as the former mayor of Iguala. None, however, are facing charges of enforced disappearance, a crime under international law which would explicitly recognize the role of government actors. Attorney Vidulfo Rosales, who represents the students' families, says the